I'm Ari Redford, and this is TRM Talks. I am Global Head of Policy at TRM Labs. At TRM, we provide blockchain intelligence software to support law enforcement investigations and to help financial institutions and cryptocurrency businesses mitigate financial crime risk within the emerging digital asset economy. Prior to joining TRM, I spent 15 years in the U.S. federal government, first as a prosecutor at the Department of Justice, and then as a Treasury Department official, where I worked to safeguard the financial system against terrorist financiers, weapons of mass destruction proliferators, drug kingpins, and other rogue actors. On TRM Talks, I sit down with business leaders, policymakers, investigators, and friends from across the crypto ecosystem who are working to build a safer financial system. Today, we're going to be talking to Jessica Davis, president of Insight Threat Intelligence and counterterrorism subject matter expert. But first, inside the lab, where I share data-driven insights from our blockchain intelligence team. Late last year, the UK's HM Treasury announced financial sanctions for human rights violations against individuals and entities connected to Malaysia, Cambodia, Myanmar, Thailand, China, and Laos for their involvement in the trafficking of individuals forced to work as scammers, targeting English speakers. The victims are subject to physical abuse, often cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment or punishment. And this is the first time that financial sanctions have been used to target the human trafficking networks that are involved in pig butchering. Pig butchering is a huge problem globally. According to a report by the United Nations, thousands of victims are trafficked across Southeast Asia and brutally forced to engage in pig butchering and other scams. While the recent UK sanctions do not specifically mention pig butchering, the descriptions of the conduct and the entities and locations identified are consistent with the UN report. The UN report says that at least 120,000 people across Myanmar are held in scam compounds or situations where they are forced to carry out scams. And a further 100,000 in Cambodia, Laos, the Philippines, and Thailand are also identified as countries of destination or transit for tens of thousands of trafficked people. In pig butchering schemes, scammers encounter victims on dating sites, social media websites, or even random text masquerading as a wrong number. The scammer builds a relationship with the individual over time and eventually persuades the individual to invest more and more money and send those funds to a fake investment app. Once the scammer gets as much money out of the victim as possible, the scammer vanishes with all the money. The term pig butchering comes from the idea of fattening up the victim as much as possible before stealing the funds. TRM identified about $10 billion being sent to various types of fraud schemes in 2023. Law enforcement globally continues to be focused on this issue. Definitely check out our TRM talks with Aaron West, a prosecutor in Santa Clara, who's really shined a light on this issue globally. And we worked with Homeland Security investigations, the FBI, IRS, CIA, and others to identify not only victims of fraud and scams, but also the networks that are engaged in human trafficking. For much more on pig butchering and mitigating the risks, check out our insights page at trmlabs.com. All right, now let's sit down with threat intelligence expert, Jessica Davis. Jessica, thank you so much for joining TRM Talks.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me, Ari.
I'm so often told you should absolutely talk to Jessica Davis. So I've been wanting to have this conversation for a while. How did all of this start for Jessica Davis?
It's a bit of a longer story, so settle in. But it really started for me in about 1999 when I joined the Royal Military College of Canada, our version of West Point. At the time, I joined the Canadian military, and it was a peacekeeping military. So our mission was doing things like Bosnia, that kind of thing, really different. And then 2001 happens, and I'm in my third year. And immediately overnight, we become a warfighting military. That had a couple of particular impacts, mainly that a number of my friends and colleagues who I served with went to Afghanistan, and a number of them never came home. So there was a real personal motivation for me in terms of counterterrorism. But the other side of this is that during this time and in the years that followed, I really saw some of the excesses of the global war on terrorism, things like disproportionate targeting of Muslim charities. And the injustice of a lot of that really spurred me on to get even more involved and more invested in counterfinancing and counterterrorism at large. So that's sort of where it all came from. And just to sort of hit the agencies that I'm sure your listeners will want to hear about, you know, I started at D&D, our Canadian Armed Forces, went over to Global Affairs Canada afterwards, went to our financial intelligence unit, FinTrack, for a number of years, where I was the team leader on terrorist financing and did a lot of really interesting work there, as I'm sure you can imagine. I was recruited into our Canadian Security Intelligence Service from there during, you know, the height of the Islamic State. Around 2018, I left government and set up my own shop. And that was really motivated by this feeling that I'd kind of hit this wall in terms of the advice that I was giving to government. I didn't really feel like I was having the kind of impact that I wanted to have. I saw a lot of bad policies being made in Canada, but internationally as well, that weren't really evidence-based. So I wanted to be able to yell about that publicly as loud as I wanted to.
It's really extraordinary. I'd love to kind of dig in a little bit to some of that. I think for a lot of folks, 9/11 was very much a watershed, obviously, in history, but in their lives too, personally. It sounds like a lot of your works goes back to how you felt personally around that. And then also what happened to global national security infrastructure. Would you talk a little bit about like what happened at that moment, right, in Canada in particular?
Yeah, and the piece that I sort of glossed over at this time is that when I was at the Royal Military College, my father was in the military as well. He was actually posted to Washington, D.C. So he was in D.C. on 9/11 when the Pentagon was hit. And so when I went home at Canadian Thanksgiving, you know, we drove by the Pentagon. So it had a very real feeling for me. And I would say that that's actually true in Canada in general. This really became something that galvanized the Canadian security intelligence community for the better part of the next, you know, 15, 20 years, really, and continues to have lasting impacts. And you just don't see that kind of event and sort of shrug your shoulders. You know, you see the harm and the injustice and the civilian lives that are lost in that. And it's very impactful. And, you know, I think sometimes people forget that as terrorism researchers and threat research generally, the personal element is always front and center for us. You know, to a certain extent, I try to not think about it all that much because it can become so overwhelming. But when you think for 2 minutes about why you're doing what you're doing, it's because you care about people and you want the world to be a safer and better place.
So beautifully said. I lived 5 blocks from the White House on 9/11, and I'll never forget taping my windows with duct tape on the sides to ensure that any sort of chemicals didn't get through from whatever the next terror attack was going to be. And yeah, I mean, it does become something that is personal and drives the type of work that you do.
One of the things that really impacted me today is what's happening in lots of different parts of Africa with terrorism. We have largely pushed this problem out of our countries, but a lot of other countries in the world have not been as lucky. And so that chilling effect that you're talking about is taking a real toll on emerging and growing economies in Africa and the people that live there. The same can be said about many different countries around the world, but these are the kinds of things that really make me want to do what I do.
Absolutely. And to that end, before we maybe dig into some of the geopolitical, talk a little bit about your work today, right? We've hired a fair amount of people from the U.S. federal government and globally as well at TRM. And a lot of them will say something like what you said, and that is, you know, you're hitting your head against the bureaucracy for years. But wow, what an opportunity to be able to sort of help more broadly, to be able to scale the work that you were doing, right, in the private sector, to work with government. Talk a little bit about your work today at Insight and sort of what you're building.
Yeah, I do a few different things. So one of the things that I do is a lot of investigative and in-depth research, and this is all client-driven. So clients, international organizations, national governments, the private sector, non-governmental organizations will come to me with a particular problem and say, Jess, we want you to do an in-depth investigation or analysis on this. And that's, I would say, the bulk of my work, like 50 to 55% of the time. The other two pieces are really education and training, and then a public-facing awareness piece. The training and education, I think, is really important because I see a lot of bad advice being given to up-and-coming investigators and analysts. So I really want to make sure that the people that I'm training have the best evidence base possible. The other piece, that public-facing, is really done through Insight Monitor, which is my newsletter, and then some public talks that I give or some talks that I give for even private institutions with hundreds or thousands of people to raise awareness around the issues around terrorist financing and why people should care about it. This is so hard for people because money is sort of sometimes a taboo subject. People are uncomfortable about it. And so for me, it's about socializing the issues and why we really need to be working on this.
We talk all the time on this show, and we'll continue to, about how every crime is a financial crime. It is all about bad actors all need funds. Terrorism is probably even more interesting because you don't need a lot of funds, right? This isn't North Korea where you need to fund a weapons of mass destruction program. It's you have to carry out a terror attack, so they need less.
Yeah, and we've talked about a lot about terrorism today, but you know, my practice is a lot broader. I think about it as more illicit finance at large. And so, for instance, right now I'm working on a really big and long-term investigation on a non-state actor that is not a terrorist entity. So I'll leave that up to the imagination of your listeners, but it's much broader than just terrorism.
You mentioned something I just want to kind of double tap on real quick. Investigators and folks in the government today, what are you seeing out there today and what's wrong with it? And maybe what type of advice are you giving to sort of course correct some of the work that's being done in the threat intelligence space?
There's a lot of misinformation about terrorist financing and threat financing writ large. I think one of the things that you said was really interesting a minute ago. You talked about how terrorism doesn't cost a lot of money. And I agree, except also it does. When I think about terrorism or threat financing writ large, I think about it in both operational and organizational contexts. So for a terrorist attack, that might be a very low cost event. We might be talking thousands or even sometimes hundreds of dollars, often a lot more. But when we look at a group like Hamas or Hezbollah, we're not talking about small amounts of money here. We're talking about hundreds of millions, approaching billions of dollars. So for me, I think one of the main things that people need to understand is that there's just this incredible range of activity and this incredible price tag that's attached to all of these different activities. You know, that's one of the key pieces. The second piece is really around media reporting around threat financing and illicit finance. So just the other day, and I'm going to throw a well-known publication under the bus here, because I think they can take it. I was reading The Economist, and it said that Hamas generates $500 million from its investment portfolio. But the US government has said that Hamas has an investment portfolio of $500 million. Both of these things can't be true. You can't generate annual revenues of $500 million from a $500 million asset portfolio. That's 100% of your assets. So which one is it? I'm inclined to side with the United States. I've seen a whole bunch of different estimates. So really, Hamas is taking a percentage of that revenue portfolio from its investment portfolio. And I think this is the kind of problem that we see in that reporting. Like, it's so easy to slip in terms of how we're using the language and how precise we're being. And all of a sudden, Hamas's annual revenues have grown by $480 million, which doesn't help us create better policy. It just overstates the problem and doesn't help us target what we need to be doing.
Yeah, no, really well said. And we'll get to this in a moment. But we had this issue arise right after October 7th with the Wall Street Journal publicizing some pretty bad data on crypto and terror financing. That speaks really to your issue, is that these issues are very nuanced. Oftentimes that nuance gets lost. Let me ask you about exactly kind of what you started on a moment ago, and that is the landscape. And let's stay with terror financing for a moment, because that's where we are. What are you seeing? What are the trends? Who are the major players? And how are we thinking about sort of mitigating some of those risks?
It's difficult for me to conceptualize this as a trends issue because I see almost like quite different pieces of it. So the pieces that I look at when I think about terrorist financing today are things like those big groups. So Hamas, Hezbollah, Islamic State, because they have large revenue bases, large finance networks, which concerns me over the long term.
Is Al-Qaeda not part of this conversation anymore as you're really sort of digging into this work? Talk me through that.
There are some Al-Qaeda affiliated groups that I would put in that upper tier of areas of concern. But if I'm looking at the big, the high level, the macro, that's where I would say those three groups. But, you know, if we're talking about like a particular part of Africa, then that might come up. And so this is the thing that, you know, I think it's so difficult also to compare threat levels across all of this different place because it's, you know, apples to oranges in many cases. When I look at Canada and the United States, those are not the groups that are actually on the top of my list. I'm more concerned with, we call it ideologically motivated violent extremists in Canada. So your neo-Nazis, your anti-authoritarians, you name it in that sort of bucket, your incels. I'm worried about that. And the financing piece there is really different than it is for the big groups. We're talking much more self-finance, small amounts of money. The financial intelligence is still very important in terms of detecting and disrupting those threats, but it's orders of magnitude different and requires a bit of a different skill set.
In the wake of January 6th, I did a TRM talks with Mary McCord at Georgetown and another researcher on the topic. And it was so interesting to explore the crypto nexus to some of the right-wing extremist groups. Whereas I've always sort of looked at this in the sort of foreign terrorist lens. There's such a range when you're talking about what is potentially terrorism too.
Yeah, exactly. And I think we have to ask really specific questions, particularly when we're thinking about like policy or investigations, making sure that we're precise in that so that we're not omitting a particular threat or a particular category. That's one of the reasons I struggle with that kind of question, because I'm like, well, it really depends on what sort of frame we're putting on it and what we're trying to get to at the end of the day.
This is a pretty specific question. Let's talk Hamas. In the wake of October 7th, the Hamas attack on Israel, the world has been sort of focused on how do they possibly fund that attack? That was a attack that required a large amount of funding and funding over time. Talk a little bit about what you're seeing in your research and your work in terms of how Hamas is financed and then how the attack was financed to the extent that we sort of have any view on that today.
One of the things that we do with my newsletter, Insight Monitor, is really try to delve into how particular attacks are financed. This is a difficult exercise. A lot of the information tends to be classified, or we have to do like estimates about what things might have cost. The Hamas attacks are one thing that we're looking at right now. So I don't have really an answer for you about specifically how that attack was financed. Based on other attacks that we've sort of costed out and analyzed, I wouldn't be surprised if the cost of that attack comes in over $1 million. And if the financing for it took place over the course of 2 or 3 years in terms of procurement and all of that kind of activity. But stay tuned for the actual assessment on that. But we do know a lot about Hamas financing. I'm really happy to say that we've released our Hamas financing report. So it's an amalgamation of all of the research that we've done over the last 3 months, really looking in depth at how the group raises money, how they use it for all those procurement activities, how they store and manage it so that the sprawling financial network that is their investment portfolio, how they're moving it. So it has that crypto piece in it, but it also has a huge reliance on cash couriers, money service businesses, and Hawala. And then what kind of financial tradecraft they use. So how they're hiding the use and movement of these funds. That report comes out today. It's 30 pages long, but it's also full of intelligence gaps. And I point this out because one of the challenges I think we've had with Hamas finance is that a lot of intelligence agencies and governments around the world, I think, kind of forgot about Hamas before October 7th. I think that this was not a priority. We've talked about some of the other priorities, Islamic State, Al-Qaeda, but Hamas fell off that tier and never came back on it. I think this is a bit of an intelligence failure in and of itself, obviously, given the scope and scale of the attacks that happened. But I think it's also really demonstrates how countries struggle to hold more than one terrorist financing priority at a given time. Part of this is likely due to underfunding of counterterrorism financing investigations and resources. So, you know, if we're doing something on Islamic State, we also do not have the resources to do something on Hamas. But I think there's also, you know, a lack of political will in some instances. So the report has plenty of intelligence gaps in it. A lot of the information that's come out over the last few days and months has been a little bit dated or stale or based on older assessments. So I think we still have a lot to learn about Hamas financing. My bottom line on Hamas is really that they have a resilient and redundant financing network, and that I do not think that it's going to be particularly easy to disrupt in the short term.
If I can ask the why of that last point. Why will it be hard to disrupt in the short term?
When we look at where Hamas is storing some of its assets, really speaks to that why. So let's start actually in Gaza. If the Israeli military is successful at ousting Hamas from Gaza, my personal view is it does look like that they're not really going to have much of a foothold there in the short to medium term. Hamas still has a huge network of assets placed in countries all around the world, like the UAE, Turkey, Algeria, Sudan. These countries are important because not every one of them sees Hamas as a terrorist organization. In order to freeze and seize assets under domestic legislation, generally speaking, you have to have those entities listed as terrorist organizations in your national law, or you have to see them as terrorist entities. For many of these countries that don't view Hamas that way, they're not going to be motivated to freeze and seize those assets. I think that there are some conversations that can happen in the background. I think the United States can put a lot of pressure on some of these countries to do something about that. But the fact is that Hamas has been allowed to establish a fairly broad network of assets, facilitators, money service businesses that are going to allow it to withstand counter-terrorist financing pressure in the short to medium term.
The assumption has always been that, look, you know, between Iran, which at least the U.S. State Department has reported about $100 million a year to Hamas, tax revenue coming from imports to Gaza from Egypt and the West Bank, these investment portfolios that you referred to, this diaspora of donors globally who are sending funds, and then other sort of state funding. What am I missing? And is that like still kind of the assessment today that those are like essentially the streams of funding?
You pretty much hit it there. I would add in, you might have missed some of the aid funding that's come from Qatar.
Absolutely. I was going to say, and Israel and the US and Canada, right? And globally, any funds going to Gaza could very well have been siphoned off for this type of activity.
Yeah. And I would say that a percentage of them have almost certainly been siphoned off by Hamas. It's just sort of their modus operandi. It's common for terrorist groups to do this. And they were the de facto government in Gaza. So it stands to reason that they were taking a cut of that. And if not directly, then they were taking a cut of a lot of the economic activity happening in Gaza. So there's that whole sort of underlying economic revenue source. The other piece that you mentioned that I would like to expand on a little bit more is what I like to call identity-based support networks. So these are networks of individuals who tend to support a group or a cause. And so they'll donate money, but it could also be through registered charities. Now, I want to put a little asterisk on this because I think that the issue of charities has been overblown in many contexts. In the context of Hamas, I would say we have to be particularly careful not to just paint every charity that donates money to the Palestinian territories as a Hamas supporter. There's a little bit of a tendency to do that in some analytic circles, but there is some evidence that support networks exist in the charitable sector as well for Hamas. So those are some of those broader pieces. But yeah, I think the big ones are really Iran, investment portfolio, and then economic activity in Gaza. But only one of those is solved by the Israeli counterterrorism offensive. Iran isn't solved, and international investments are not solved.
The one piece I didn't mention, and this is TRM talk, so I'm going to mention, is cryptocurrency. Post October 7th, there was a massive global conversation around whether or not Hamas is using crypto to raise funds. I spent a lot of time as part of that conversation and have my own views. Generally speaking, our view is that Hamas has certainly used crypto to raise funds. They were an early adopter 2018, 2019 in using Telegram channels and website infrastructure to solicit funds in Bitcoin. But that has not played a huge role since October 7th. We've not seen fundraising from official Hamas channels. I think we've seen some of it from actually what you described, and I'm blanking on your word. I call them sort of supporters, but you had a much better—
Identity-based support networks.
Identity-based support networks. I think we've seen some fundraising on a smaller scale from those networks. And obviously, we've also seen Israeli authorities and U.S. authorities and others target those networks, and they seem to come down very fast. Anyway, that is sort of like my 1 minute of what I'm seeing, but would love kind of your crypto take on what you're seeing.
Everyone should take a break right now and turn the volume down because you're going to get my crypto rant. And I get a little passionate about this because it really annoys me. So yes, I completely agree with everything that you're saying. Hamas has used crypto. They're early adopters. They had good tradecraft at the beginning. Israeli counter-terrorist financing, though, is also very good at getting it down and tracking it and disrupting it. The thing that annoys me the most about this is that whenever we talk about crypto and terrorist financing, it tends to suck all of the oxygen out of the room in terms of any other and often much more important method of raising funds. So if we're talking about crypto, we're often not talking about things like cash couriers or money service businesses or hawala, which I would argue are much more important in terms of paths for money movements in almost every context. So it really winds me up when I see like bad reporting on crypto, overstatements about crypto, and like those clickbait headlines. That being said, I think that there was one very interesting report. I think it was the Wall Street Journal that did it, which is interesting given their earlier issues, talking about Iran using cryptocurrency as a method of moving its state sponsorship of Hamas to the group. And this is also where I like to get a little bit nerdy. You know, technically speaking, I would never describe cryptocurrency as a fundraising technique. I would say it's a fund movement technique because it's what's happening is that you're moving money from one place to another with crypto. You know, generally speaking, they're not using crypto to buy weapons, components, devices, and all that kind of stuff. And it's an important distinction because it's still, as you were mentioning, the identity-based support networks that are moving money to Hamas using crypto. It's like using money service businesses to move money to Hamas or PayPal or whatever. It's the method. And here in the Iran context, I found that to be a very compelling story because I think you and I might have talked about this offline. We have increasingly seen the marriage between hawaladars and cryptocurrency exchanges, informal ones, brokerages, etc. And I find this to be a compelling story. I don't necessarily know that it's true, and I'm not sure that I'm fully bought into the idea that Iran has used cryptocurrency in this manner, but I do think it passes an initial plausibility probe.
Terrific. And I would love to know if this is exactly where you're going with this, is that we've seen, obviously, for years and years, networks of hawalas and shell companies and ways that people were moving funds. A lot of these networks are now using crypto, maybe Bcash, which was now a sanctioned Gaza-based exchange. Really a crypto hawala, if you will. Is that kind of where you're seeing it's just like a tech upgrade to a lot of the ways these guys have been moving money in the past?
That's exactly it. So it's the same activity, just a new technology.
Why is it? You know, like when Russia invaded Ukraine, the world sanctioned the Russian central bank. Like that's where the conversation should have been, right? Instead, it was like, can Russia use crypto to evade potentially $1 trillion in sanctions exposure? Why is it that crypto sucks the oxygen out of the room like that?
It's just so sexy, Ari. People just are like mystified by it. It has all of this Wild West finance stuff going on. I personally love crypto. I have crypto investments. I find it just a really fascinating space. And I think even for people who don't understand it, it has this immediate appeal, this immediate draw. But I think the thing that's so interesting about that is that the interest in crypto really speaks to our lack of understanding about money itself. Because, you know, people that I teach this a lot and I talk to people about crypto a lot, one of the first things people say to me is, but there's no intrinsic or inherent value in crypto. And then we get to open up the rabbit hole of what's the intrinsic value of the $5 bill in your hand. And I find that to be the most fun thing in the crypto space. But I think that same mystique really speaks to people's lack of understanding of the monetary system and economics and finance in general, that they maybe wouldn't have been able to articulate. And so they are able to like channel it in the crypto space.
Yeah, it's beautifully said. You read these histories of finance, right, that start with whatever the pebbles in someone's hand that someone else accepts for trade and goes from there. I think crypto is probably a chapter in that longer story, as you see it, of the growth of a global financial system. I think I just need to stop making it so sexy, Jessica. You mentioned at the sort of start that obviously you're focused on so many other risks, and I don't want to just talk Terra financing today. What are the threats that you're sort of most focused on? And I think maybe the wrinkle would be like, what are the threats that your clients are engaging you on most these days?
The way I see the threats is always through that finance angle. But that still parallels, I think, what's happening globally in terms of the magnitude of the threat. So I like to break my threats down into long-term and short-term threats. So my long-term threats tend to be existential in nature. Some of you might be aware that in Canada, we've had some pretty serious issues around Chinese foreign influence. I see that as a long-term existential threat. It doesn't have necessarily short-term threat to life impacts, but it does have impacts on democracy and our way of life. And so that's one of the things that I'm looking at. And there's finance all over it, right? It's people don't necessarily think about foreign influence activities and finance, but you have to pay the people that you want to get them doing the things that you want them to do.
We've seen a couple high profile cases involving cryptocurrency for just that, right? People transferring funds for spy type of activity and foreign influence for sure. Yeah, interesting.
Exactly. And then the other pieces are really things, you know, Russia, they're a source of incredible instability in the world, from their war in Ukraine to their private military corporations operating in Africa. This to me is also one of those longer term existential threats. For some people who are facing that threat on the ground, it is a short term immediate threat to life issue. But I think for us globally, it is one of those more existential issues that does undermine democracy and our way of life. And then, of course, there's things like sanctions evasion, money laundering linked to organized crime. To me, that is one of those insidious things that has just been allowed to run amok in our financial system for so long. And it really gets me on a fairness level. You know, I think about the people who are struggling to buy groceries, and then I look at criminals making hundreds of millions of dollars a year and not paying any taxes on that money, undermining our society and our financial system. And it just, again, like the crypto issue, it really grinds my gears. But the thing that I think is interesting is that in every single one of those threats, crypto has come up.
Talk me through that, because that was literally going to be my follow-up.
Yeah. And I think you said it, and we talked about this a minute ago when we talked about, you know, it's the same method, same motivations, just a tech upgrade. Crypto is so useful for these things. It can be so fast to send money. If you're making investments, you can make money by storing some funds in crypto. It can be anonymous-ish. You know, we'll always caveat around that. If you take enough precautions, you can make it a little bit harder for investigators to follow. I will never think that crypto is as anonymous as cash, obviously. But, you know, there are some technological advantages to it, particularly when we're doing things like large-scale money laundering. But for things like sanctions evasion too, for things like foreign influence activities, espionage financing, it's useful in all of these different contexts as one mechanism. Not the only mechanism for moving money, but it does add diversity and technology and speed to a threat actor's portfolio of options.
How often are you having conversations around crypto in these different sort of categories as you're advising clients today? Is it something that is top of mind for folks in these different threat categories?
It may not be top of mind for my clients when they start with me, but I make sure that it's included in our collection plan for every piece of work that we're doing. Because my view about these kinds of things is that you're not going to see it unless you're looking for it. So if I'm tackling a particular investigation and I'm developing a collection plan for all the different sources that I'm going to consult, I'm going to be specifically looking for cryptocurrency and indicators of cryptocurrency use. In every investigation that I've done over the last 5 years, only two or three have not had any crypto nexus. And that was very jurisdictionally specific.
That's really interesting. And that's obviously you doing your threat intelligence gathering, but it seems like something we're seeing more and more. TRM did a recent law enforcement survey that said overwhelmingly more and more investigators are seeing crypto in their cases. IRSCI in the US just put out like a Billboard top 10 money laundering investigations list for end of 2023. Four of those 10 had crypto as sort of a big part of it. And obviously I'm talking the investigative piece, but really you're seeing it in your sort of intelligence briefings as well.
Yeah. And when I'm doing investigations and research, I want to make sure that I'm advising my clients based on what's actually happening. So depending on the jurisdiction, it may not be a major threat, but I want my clients to always have the skills to be able to start to identify it. Because if you wait until you're sure that you have crypto problems in your jurisdiction, it's too late. The horse is well out of the barn. You are now playing catch up. So I'm trying to position some of my clients that maybe don't see this threat right now to get ready for it, because it's coming for everyone. It's just a matter of time.
You said something a couple minutes ago, and I just wanted to focus on this as we sort of conclude a bit here. I think it was in the terror financing context, and it hit a chord because, you know, I was a national security prosecutor for some time. We talked all the time about other prosecutors in our office were always reacting to something happening, right? You'd go investigate it. But what we were always trying to do was stop something bad from happening in the first place. And that got very scary. And that's what you've done your entire career, right? You know, over the last decade plus. How do you deal with that? How do you not see threats everywhere in your personal life?
Living in Canada, I have a very safe perspective on things. I'm very lucky that way. I just have like a lot of privilege. You know, I don't live in a lot of uncertainty. So personally, it doesn't always feel like I'm under threat all the time. But I will tell you a story about how this does affect me personally, because I think it's really important for people to understand that this kind of stuff matters. So back in about 2014 or 2015, I was working for the Canadian Security Intelligence Service, and I was looking to stop people from traveling from Canada to go overseas. And part of my work was to look at the financial picture to try to determine who amongst many subjects of investigation that we had might be getting ready to go overseas. And at one point in time, somebody asked me to take a look at someone's data and say, you know, Jess, do you see anything here that gives you pause or, you know, fits with any of the typologies you've been developing? And I said, yeah, this looks very concerning to me just based on a number of financial transactions I was looking at and some financial information. And they made a call, and it turns out that individual had left Canada that morning. And that kind of failure to me stays very personal, because there's a certain element of if I'd looked at that data sooner, someone's life, maybe many people's lives, would have been very different. So while I don't necessarily feel personally threatened in my daily life or see threats everywhere, I do keep those kinds of failures very close, because I find it very motivating to think about how I can be improving Canadian security, international security, and the lives of people around me.
It's really beautifully said. And I think it goes to your life's work of, right, like when you were in government, you're focused head down on whatever specific issue is right in front of you at that moment. But I feel like now in your role, you can kind of see a little bit of a bigger picture and really try to educate the world on so many of these different threats, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I take that small example and I try to blow it up to more of a macro scale. And sort of when I'm advising clients, I keep it in the back of my mind, like I'm trying to prepare them to help them prevent these kinds of incidents. And the funny thing about that work is if I'm really good at it and successful, I never hear from them again, because they have been successful and they have prevented the issue. And, you know, I might get a little note at some point in time that says, oh, you know, that was a really great session. It really helped us do our job. But if there's nothing that happens in the follow-up, that's actually a win. And so ultimately, I'm trying to put myself out of work.
I absolutely love that. What's top of mind for you for 2024, professionally and then personally for Jessica Davis? What's up right now?
It's a bit of a twofer on that one, because 2024 is the year that I finish my PhD.
Oh, amazing. Okay.
And it's all about counterterrorist financing and how we measure effects and outcomes. Like, what are we doing and how do we know that it works? Or how do we know that it doesn't work? Which I think is equally important. So this is the year that gets wrapped up. So June, July, I'll be submitting my dissertation. And next time we have this, you'll be addressing me as Dr. Davis.
I love that. And I can't wait to have Dr. Davis on the show. It sounds like a threat intel piece waiting to happen. How is this going to be more than just a dissertation?
Yeah. So there's already one chapter that's been published in Terrorism and Political Violence, like describing counter-terrorist financing policies and practices. So I can share that with you and you can put it in the links. But the broader project will probably end up being a book on counter-terrorist financing and sort of talking through what that looks like in practice.
That's fantastic. Congratulations. I know those
Thank you.
I mean, you built a business and are providing threat intelligence to clients and customers all over the world, and you've been a PhD student for the last 5 years.
It's been busy.
And I see you everywhere on probably the biggest issue in the world today. So like, oh my God, Jessica, that's unbelievable. Wow, congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for joining TRM Talks. This was an awesome conversation. And thank you for all the work you do. It's so important.
Thank you so much. And thanks for having me on. I'm a big fan of TRM. So it's great to be here and contributing to your outreach.
That was a really special conversation. What really struck me as extraordinary is the way that her sort of personal reaction, where she was in the moment on 9/11 20 years ago, has so informed her life's work. One of the sort of things we talk about terror financing is that it doesn't take a lot of money. I thought she made a great distinction of sort of correcting me, like, well, one act of terror might not cost a lot of money, but the types of infrastructure and organization and things that these different groups are building does. And Hamas is a great example of that. Next on TRM Talks, I sit down with author, journalist, and friend, Emily Parker. If you love the show, leave a review wherever you're listening to it. For more crypto insights, you can also subscribe to the TRM Weekly Roundup at trmlabs.com.
TRM Talks is brought to you by TRM Labs, the leading provider of blockchain intelligence and anti-money laundering software. This episode was produced in partnership with Voltage Productions. The music for this show was provided by Ecolix.
Now, let's get back to building.